To cut the story short, this verse is a kind of respect to women. There is no insult. It is telling the whole human beings that women are one of the two main parts of the society. Men and women are equal. Without women, there is no continuation of the generation. It is like having seeds without any field. So this is the importance that Allah... So
that's the meaning of the sowing field. Exactly. A very beautiful, actually, symbolic meaning then.
Exactly.
Dear Sheikh, you said about the about anal sex that one of the reasons that it is discouraged is that it has no fruitful outcome, meaning that a child will not be born out of this. Mm-hmm. Then a question naturally arises, then what about oral intercourse? Because, of course, no child is conceived here. Mm-hmm. Is that the same ruling we follow here, or is there like something else we say here according to our jurisprudence? Yeah.
There are two topics here. First of all, when we are talking about this verse is talking to that intimate relationship which leads to, giving birth to a child. So this verse is talking about that. Does it mean that this verse, prohibit other ways of intimate relationship? Not at all. For those, we need to refer to other verses and narrations. So oral sex is not understood from this verse, but this verse does not reject that. As I mentioned, it does not reject anal sex as well. It is silent about that. We cannot deduce the permission of anal sex from that, from this verse. We cannot deduce the permission of oral sex from this verse as well.
That is our own reasoning,
yeah.
And we cannot do that.
And when it comes to oral sex, according to the Shia scholars, as far as I know, they say that it is allowed with some conditions that they need to pay attention to.
Dear Sheikh, thank you very much for your time today on this very sensitive issue and matter that is very important to many Muslim couples, actually. Thank you for joining us, as always. And this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadiri, broadcasting to you from IRRB English Radio, from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you very much for tuning in.
لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Democracy, directed by Swiss filmmaker David Burnett. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is John Rees, who is a writer, broadcaster, and author. Now, Democracy is a documentary that gives you an amazing insight into the legislative process at EU level, offering a compelling story about a handful of politicians trying to protect society in the digital world from the dangers of big data and mass surveillance. And following two long years full of pitfalls and accelerated by the upheaval of the Snowden affair, parliamentarian Jan-Philipp Albrecht and European Commissioner Viviane Reding worked together for a new law on the protection of personal data.
say data is the new oil, the oil of the 21st century. If you think about how oil has transformed our lives, data is going to do the same thing.
Der Knoten meines Lebens. Wenn ich da als Minister sitzen würde, würde ich auch jemanden zuhören, der keine Krawatte trägt. Es geht darum, dass sie eine Datenschutzverordnung verabschieden sollen.
Data protection is a fundamental right, and the companies have the duty to explain what they do with our data.
European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused.
That causes jobs to leave the European Union.
Our life is about data. Data are money.
Surveillance is about managing populations, managing people.
That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
It is our responsibility to get these rights in place.
Who do you think would like to stop the directive?
Well, I think we know the usual suspects.
Well, first of all, warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary tackles an important issue of our time and gets behind the scenes of the European privacy debate. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on democracy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fascinating and important subject, but for me, sadly, deeply unpersuasive treatment. I mean, it's by nature, you know, if you're going to follow lots of bureaucratic meetings with people kind of, you know, arguing over very, minutiae of clauses and things like that, there needs to be something to grip an audience. And, you know, first of all, it's filmed in this kind of very kind of nondescript greyish black and white. But I guess the director would say he's probably trying to avoid sensationalism or dumbing down.
Well, some critics have actually praised the film and its efforts and its monochrome sort of sequences and the black and white feel to it, because it is an incredibly tough subject to film and follow through. Perhaps the director made it, for new audiences, watchable, given it's a tough subject.
I mean, if people get something out of it, that's great. All I can talk to is my experience of it. And I do think this is an issue that, because it sounds quite boring, people do switch off. And I think unless you're preaching to the converted, if you want more people to be engaged in this issue and you want them to sort of sit up and take notice, you need to get their attention.
Just to bring in John here. John, are we as a society largely ignorant about data protection issues? Surely this film can help persuade people of this argument.
Well, it leaves people going away with the idea, maybe I must find out what it's about. And also the critical thing you see here is what happens when corporations that are privately assembling data for consumer management, which is one issue, an important issue, flips over into state access to that data. And that's what the Snowden case, of course, revealed. And that's that's the only time
on.
When the film really kicks off.
Ladies and gentlemen, the citizens are very worried. 72% of European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused. Our reform will assure a high protection to the individuals. A single set of European rules on data protection, fit for the digital age, valid everywhere across the European Union, on the basis that the personal data belongs to the person.
When I became Commissioner for Justice and responsible for the protection of the citizens, I knew at that moment I had to reform the data protection rules. Without trust, no digital economy. So it is in the own interest of the politicians who want to develop our economy and of the industry who wants to take advantage of the personal data of the individuals, that clear rules are established so that citizens know, all right, I can hand out my data. That is exactly what we need. Because in this new digital world, no service can function without the data. The data are needed.
So that was beyond the importance of data protection, Lee, what else does this film tell us about the significance of data protection? What arguments does it make, and you know, why is it so controversial?
Well, I mean, all the arguments that Vivian Reddy makes and Jan-Philipp Albrecht, they're all absolutely valid, and they're things that we should be concerned about. But I would question one of the things she says there. She says, without trust, no digital economy. Now, the fact is, a lot of people, as they say, don't trust it, but actually, we all are kind of complicit because we so easily give our consent and agree to things and share our details that actually the digital economy seems to be doing quite well. And the issue is, why are we so pliant, and why do we give our consent so easily? And this is the thing. A film like this, or anything that discusses this, whether it's a news program or a documentary, should be trying to alert us and give concrete examples of what is happening with this data and why we should be more concerned.
Surely this is a testament to the documentary then. It's just simply following sort of the bureaucratic process and that bringing to light and to this issue to the public eye, whereas we would otherwise not know about these issues.
Well, again, I think its heart is in the right place. It wants to do that. I just don't believe it does. What this does is follow very diligently and, you know, obviously taking a long time, the trail, you know, the process of getting these laws applied.
So, John, for viewers who haven't seen this documentary, could you help contextualise this issue of data protection? Why is it such a huge issue?
Well, what for the first time in history you've got is major corporations being able to track, not by name, and that's important, but in general patterns, consumer behaviour at quite a detailed level. And there's a question mark about whether or not that should be, the degree to which that should be able to be done, and certainly able to be done without consent. And that's an important issue. But, and I have to say, that clip is very revealing, although the filmmaker doesn't make very much of it, because the film is framed as if it's a battle of, you know, kind of libertarians against the power of the corporations. But that's not what the EU does. And in fact, what the EU does is it excludes cowboy capitalism so that the really big guys can agree on the rules and compete on that basis. That's what it does for the European area.
So who else can we rely on then to ensure that these checks and balances
well,
are
we're
in
coming,
place?
We're coming to that, because the people who are actually the heroes of this story and the person who ignites this film is Edward Snowden. And those are the people who should, you know, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, all right, nice guy, green, trying to do his best, thinks the EU is a marvelous institution, wants the corporations to behave reasonably, fair enough. But that isn't really the person that smashes open this whole debate, even in this film. And he's supposed to be the hero of this film.
Interesting point you make. And we'll touch on Snowden again, as I mentioned, a bit later on. And Lee, if I could just quickly ask you, what were some of the obstacles that Jan faced then in trying new lobbying efforts?
Well, I mean, you know, this basic assumption that citizens are consumers and therefore we should be treated as such. It's like, therefore, you know, what's wrong? We're going to give you what you want. This is a shortcut. If we know, you know, the things that you're interested in and where, you know, what your daily existence is about, we can help facilitate that. Now, obviously, that's a very positive spin on that. The downside is, you know, it's about commerce and it's about selling things to people. And unfortunately, kind of the positive benefits seem to get easily swept aside in the rush to kind of make sales.
I think everybody is aware that the lobby on this file is one of the most intensive that we've seen for a long time.
This has been the most heavily lobbied piece of legislation in recent years. Why is it causing so much stir and interest?
It is important to understand that European companies are a major part of this growing internet economy. Some of the most successful global internet companies to date are European.
The conflicts between the giant internet companies and the rights of the individual in terms of protecting their data online. What were some of the conflicts, if you could shed more light on that, between these companies and data protection?
Well, I mean, aside from the whole commercial angle, there's the surveillance side of things. And the idea that if, as John was talking about, if the companies share this information with the state, what use is that information going to be put to? So in the UK, you know, famously, the sort of Snoopers Charter that came, you know, was announced November 2016, is maybe hopefully going to be
passed into law last year.
Yeah, exactly.
Also known as the Snoopers Charter.
Yeah, exactly. So that whole idea is, if you get someone in charge, I mean, the US is perhaps a good example, who looks like they're cracking down on kind of, you know, freedom of information and things, mm-hmm. then maybe that information is going to be misused. And this is a big worry for people. It's like, if you can pinpoint, maybe without specific names, but, you know, being able to identify people by so many characteristics, where does that, it's basically, where's this going to go? Mm-hmm. And if you're allowing this stage's, you know, gradual sort of erosion, then, you know, it's open to abuse in the future.
Mm-hmm. And John, so this film implies that giant internet companies such as Google, Microsoft, Facebook, etc., Yahoo, for example, that they have invested interests in data, against data protection. They don't like to be associated with these sorts of laws and things. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think every capitalist corporation just wants as much freedom as possible to gather as much information about its customers as possible and use it how it likes without legal regulation, transparency or oversight. I think that's a kind of given, and not just in this industry, by the way, but right across the board. I mean, big corporations are some of the most secretive bodies in our society. I mean, probably only the state secret service agencies are more secretive than giant oil companies or giant car companies, and of course industrial espionage is a thing. So, you know, I think we have to take that as one of the ways in which a competitive profit-seeking system works. That's what they want. That's what they want it to do.
So how can an individual, take on sort of a giant corporation like that?
You can't as an individual. The imbalance in power is too great. That's why they are collective, powerful collective entities. And if you're going to take them on, you need powerful collective entities on your side as well. Mass protest movements, trade union organisations, labour organisations. That's why that kind of.
But why don't we see this then? Do you think there's an ignorance then on the public part?
No, I do think that, and this film kind of underlines this. Yes, there's massive corporate lobbying going on. I think at one point in the film they say 96% of the lobbying that took place over this piece of legislation was from corporations and their various front organisations. And that's an interesting thing, because that will be happening not just on this bill but on every conceivable piece of labour legislation that you can think about. I think people are concerned about that. We heard the figures, but you know, there are some things that are a lot closer to home than whether or not Google has got your consumer preferences, your health service, your wages, your welfare provision. These are things that are cutting into people's lives like right now and matter about fundamental things in their lives. If huge corporations get your data, perhaps they'll mis-sell you things, perhaps they'll try and sell you things you don't want, and have things about you don't know about, and that's bad. But corporations don't have the power to arrest you, try you, imprison you, deport you. Mm-hmm. That's what the state can do. Mm-hmm. And so when the state has these powers, this is a holy order different threat. And I think we've seen that the reaction to these two things by the public is different as well, because they understand that distinction.
Mm-hmm. So more sinister issues beneath the surface then. Mm.
Edward Snowden revealed that secret surveillance activities went far beyond what anyone thought possible.
Companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft got together with the NSA and provided direct access to the back ends of all communicating systems.
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures. That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
The Guardian's editor-in-chief testified before Parliament that only a fraction of the leaked files have been revealed.
It's about 1% of what we were given. Only 1% of the information in those files has now gone public.
Yes.
The EU Justice Commissioner has spoken about the leaks from Edward Snowden and says that new legislation must be put in place to protect the privacy of EU citizens.
Anybody who uses digital equipment is put under some form of surveillance. And that seems to me is something which cannot happen without consent. It cannot happen without the consent of populations. So my message to the lawmakers is, please protect us.
What's the strength of this documentary, Democracy, I think, is that it gives you an insight into the privacy battle before and after the Snowden revelations. So you sort of see that journey and struggle. Lee, how was the revelations a game changer, and did it make the EU go into more gear and make more progress?
I mean, funnily enough, the appearance of Snowden in the film mirrors his kind of, you know, explosion and effect in real life. It kind of jump starts, makes it personal, gives you a concrete example, and actually helps you understand and get a grip on something else. The impression the film gives is that that gives a new impetus to their fight. It gives something concrete, and they can point to that example of Snowden and say, you see, this is the sort of thing we're talking about. If this can happen in this case, it can also happen in these other cases, and therefore that's why our, you know, this issue is so prevalent. And I, you know, the film at least gives the impression that that helps win the argument that they're putting forward.
So finally, we get to discuss the Snowden revelations now in this part of the show. John, what did you make of the revelations, and was it a game changer for the EU and sort of the battle for privacy?
Yeah, I think Lee's absolutely right about this. I mean, it was a game changer, along with others, Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, and so forth and so on. But that's the point, really. These are things that come from the heart of the surveillance state, and they're very, very shocking. And they have a political effect about, you know, this doesn't come out in the film, and it should do, but they're about real things happening, about people losing their lives with illegal operations in Afghanistan and so forth and so on, about the treatment of prisoners by the United States and so forth. These are deeply important issues which did have a political effect, and they're about surveillance by the state. And this film doesn't really acknowledge quite what a big shift this is. It says it's a game changer in terms of their legislation, but we've suddenly moved from a film which is only discussing kind of corporate interest in data collection to the question of the state. And it's not surprising to me that that's where the film really becomes interesting. If this film had been 25 minutes long, the last 25 minutes of what impact did Edward Snowden have on privacy legislation going to the EU, that would have been quite interesting, and it is actually quite an interesting documentary. So yeah, it changes gear, but it changes political focus, and doesn't really quite acknowledge that it's doing that or why that might be important.
I just wanted to read an example now of Snowden. One of his revelations is that the NSA and the GCHQ here in the UK have far-reaching powers, particularly this country, that undermine privacy and security, variety of means, so unlocking encryption used to protect emails, for example, banking and medical records. And what's also controversial, which the film mentions, is that, you know, why should the US have the power and jurisdiction to spy on people in Europe? So one of the leaks that Snowden revealed was that an average of 3 million data intercepts per day in France, with peaks of almost 7 million in around 2012 and 2013 occurred. So this is quite, the magnitude is just unsort of believable, really. So, and surely that having the EU in place can help buffer sort of and protect us from sort of the US spying from us.
Yeah, interestingly though, we're never told in the documentary to what degree the law that they're passing actually affects the relations between private corporations and the state, and between individual. I'm not even clear at the end of this whether or not that legislation applies to state bodies or not. Now, that would have been an interesting thing to know, and to what degree, and do they avoid them, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's also a whole series of issues about the mistakes that the state system makes, because actually it can't process, it can mass data observe, but to get that down to so-and-so did so-and-so and is guilty of such-and-such is a very hard task, and the state often is misled, and injustices and miscarriages of justice arrive because it can't actually process this degree of raw data.
But so it seems like an illusion of power at this stage, more so than the capacity to follow through.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you sort of your personal thoughts on your data and how it's being used, did this film make you think and more sort of paranoid in any way, or aware of how your data is being used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, truth be told, I'm so aware of it already. You know, you go onto a social media site, you're getting an advert for something you looked at maybe on a different computer 3 weeks ago, just once. That is alarming to me. I got a new phone, I parked my car, I went off somewhere, a message came up saying, show me where my car was parked. Now, if someone else got hold of my phone, they would just have immediate access. It's obviously trying to do me a favour. Mm-hmm. Say, here's where your car is. Hopefully I would remember that, and maybe there'd be so you go out on a night and you forget where your car is, and it's a useful thing. But you're just so aware of this sort of network that's operating and, you know, able to kind of track and log and all this kind of stuff. So I have to say, sadly, this film didn't really do anything about that. And I, you know, I think what John says is very right. This change from corporate to state thing, the state thing is the real worry. I mean, the corporation stuff, definitely, you know, I have issues with. But they almost piggyback on Snowden to give themselves a sort of, you know, third act lift. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily tie in together. But it is also doing a service, because there's nothing about the issues that this film tackles that I would disagree with. It's more just the handling of it and, you know, persuading more people to kind of pay attention. I don't think this film quite does it.
And so, John, just your final thoughts on the film now.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested in a kind of 10-minute sequel, because this piece of legislation passed. We all know that, as Lee's just said, this stuff is still happening to us at an exponentially growing rate. So exactly how effective was, after that long battle, after we've watched all this, how effective really, really was it?
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Brother Hasnain Rajab Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ya ayyuhal insan, innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaki. This is the most fundamental rule, O mankind. Struggle upon struggle till you meet your Lord. People may ask, why struggle? What's the reason for struggle? And many a times we look at, well, you know, people went into depression, they went into this sense of learned helplessness because of the negatives that were faced with, the despair, you know, there was some kind of resistance that took place, it was very difficult to overcome, as a result they fell into the ditch, right? And many times we argue, we wish there were no ditches, we wish there were no resistance, we wish there was no hindrance, we wish there were no problems in life. But we must bear the fact that when we really evaluate the real nature of who we are and what we are created for, resistance and hindrance and problems are an integral part of that growth. It's impossible to grow without them. You know, the best example I use in a very simplistic way is a person who does bodybuilding, right? When they go into the gym, you will see that the more resistance they get, the stronger they're going to become and the bigger they're going to form, because you're now going to tear your muscles. Just think about it. You're going to scar your muscles, right? And when you tear your muscles, when the muscles heal, it gets larger. So you think, you know, the whole notion of tearing your muscle tissue, I mean, that's negative. No. If it's done in a very subtle way where it can handle itself without degrading the quality of the muscle, then you become stronger. So when we have problems in life, and when we have resistance, and we get good, you know, bad news, somebody just denied me what I wanted, you know, the person I love doesn't love me, the wealth that I wanted, or the job that I wanted, or that investment that I put money in no longer produced the results I thought, oh, it's the end of the world, God doesn't love me anymore, you know, I'm going to quit. And these are all the problems. Look, you are a psychotherapist, Sister Barak, you know, what is the reason, right? Many a times somebody will tell you, something happened in my past. When you study human, you know, development, the 0 to 7 years of age is the most crucial part of a child's growth period, 0 to 7. because they're essentially sponges. They don't have any comments. They don't have anything to give. They are pure takers. And what's given to them becomes the foundation of what they will start to give tomorrow. I want us to understand this. This is crucial. If we abuse a child at a young age, that means we gave them something negative to feel. And if it's large enough, it may become a bigger part of their root system. And that will also start to give off fruits tomorrow with it. So it's very important for you and I to be cognizant that we're causing these kinds of future events. And if we don't show true love and try our best to sort of alleviate, but there is a fine line. And here's the question, here's the point I want to make. It's very, very crucial for you and I to understand this. You and I cannot insulate the growth of a child on a constant basis where everything is positive and there should be no negative. That thought is just, that's an unfair system. When we have sadr, that sadr is one of the expressions of the heart. You know, the heart has many names. They have fu'ad, you have sharaf, you have sadr. These are all components of this qalb. Qalb is the generic statement in the Quran. Each part of it has capabilities. And our scholars say from the Quran, sadr is where happiness and sadness, constriction and pain comes, is sadr. When Allah says, Alam nashrah laka sadrak. When Allah says to the Prophet, did we not expand for you your heart? Here, sadr. Why? So that there should be that level of relief for the Prophet from the constriction of pain. Alam nashrah laka sadra wa wada'na anka wazrak alladhi anqadha dhahrak. It was a burden on you. It was heavy on you. It was painful. We expanded it. When Musa alayhi salam is going to Fir'aun, when Allah says, idhhab ila Fir'aun to Musa, innahu tagha. Musa alayhi salam knew who Fir'aun was because he grew up in his house. He knew how vicious this man was. He knew how wicked he is. And he knew this is a daunting task. This is not easy. This mission that God is sending me on is a daunting. It's an arduous task. It's very tough. It's like go and lift this 1,000 pounds, and more than that. Actually, that expression is nothing compared to what Musa had to face. So what does he do? He asks Allah, Rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri. Wa yassir li amri. But what is the, wa yassir li amri comes with what? Rabbi shrah li sadri. Okay, expand for me my heart, my chest. So that, and the chest, by the way, is not this. These are all components of the heart that cause things. When I smile, it's something in the heart that triggered this. And there's a reaction to my chest, to my expressions, to my ecstatic behavior. It all originates from the trigger of the heart. So Musa alayhi salam says, Rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri. Make my affair easy. Wahlul uqdatan min lisani. Loosen my tongue. Yafqaw qawli. So that they understand me. So he understands me. You find that pressure is essential to do the work of God. When we raise children, we must train them to also constrict the heart. The sadr should be constricted while it's expanded. Sister Sabira here is a pedagogue. She's a teacher. So she will understand this. And especially when you teach elementary. I know, I think you teach higher age groups, but elementary. Children, when you teach them, you find these children have to be trained to expand and contract the sadr. Then they will know how to manage the problems of tomorrow. You know what's an interesting observation? Is that you will find children raised in very wealthy communities, very wealthy families, will be put in special schools, in private schools with private teachers, and they will be given, carte blanche in their education. All the fancy tools. I know because we run Wise Academy, so we know how we deal with this, right? What's interesting is that, and you will find that if the child, something is missing, Habibi, no, give it to this child. Let them not cry, please. Habibi, don't make my child cry, please. Now, the parent should feel that, right? Because you don't want to scar this child. But we over-insulate the child. We don't let them constrict. We just keep expanding their sadr. Make them happy, 24/7. Anything they want, Habibi, you want. And then the child starts to demand. And once this child starts to demand, on the fly we supply, you know, because my child has to be good. But if you find the same child, same age range, raised in a lower income community, you will see that that child is not given the kind of carte blanche that the rich kid is given. And they struggle, they get abused in some ways, but in a reasonable way, where they're no longer that prince walking in the school. You know, you're just an ordinary kid. But they learn to contract and expand and contract and expand. Do you ever notice when these two groups become teenagers and adults, you'll find that the maturity of the lower income child is greater than the one who's wealthy? Observe, their ability to manage problems is easier for the lower income because they have been trained to constrict and expand and constrict and expand. Sometimes, of course, unfairly, which leads them to have problems in the future. But that has to be discussed because these are critical points that I'm just bringing out. Secondly, how do you manage to maintain in the trajectory of never losing hope when a boulder shows up in front of you, or when a mountain shows up in front of you? How do you continue with it? Well, I'll give you an analogy. Imagine you're walking and a tree falls in front of you. This is an analogy. There are two groups of people. One will stand there and curse the tree and curse God for having created a tree and curse the tree having fallen. And now they will keep staring at the tree, sit there, they'll actually build a campfire, and they will damn and condemn till they die. Why did that tree fall in front of me? Astaghfirullah. If you look at the human behavior sometimes, people are stuck on something that happened 20 years ago. Somebody said something, I just can't get over it. It's like we use this example, hold a bottle with a little water and you can hold it. But if you keep holding it for a month, a year, this starts to get very heavy. Right? Initially it's very light, but then it starts to get, that heaviness is us holding grudges of the past, the hindrances and the failures of our past. We can't let go. So we sit around that tree and we're condemning it. But the one who is going to progress is the one who says, huh, how do I cut this tree so I can move? Or can I go around it? And you find they go around it. What made them go around it or cut the tree? What lies beyond the tree was so vivid in their mind that they would never let the tree stop them. But if you and I are happy-go-lucky day by day with no thought of tomorrow, then when that tree falls, you and I will be very disappointed.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام رسولك ترجمان عقلك وكتابك أبلغ ما ينطق عنك.
Imam Ali said, "Your messenger is the interpreter of your intelligence, while your letter is more eloquent in expressing your true self." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the beautiful things which we learn, dear friends, from Imam Ali alayhi salam is the fact that if we live a righteous life, if we live a noble life, if we live a good life, if we live a mu'min life, then even after we pass away, people will remember these beautiful things about us. So we find in a report by Dirar ibn Damara that following the Shahada, the martyrdom of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the believers, Imam Ali alayhi salam, this guy Dirar says that I headed for Syria to see Muawiyah. He says that knowing that I was a devotee of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Muawiyah said to me, "Describe Ali for me." I said to him, "Please accept my excuse, for my tongue cannot possibly describe Ali." Muawiyah, who had made himself the caliph and the governor of Syria, he said, "Your excuse is not accepted. You must describe him to me." So Dirar again says, "Now that you refuse to accept my excuse, listen carefully. Ali was sharp-sighted, prudent, powerful, and strong in the way of Allah. What Ali said was a criterion to distinguish between what was just and unjust. Ali's judgments were fair. Ali was abounding in knowledge. Wisdom was evident in all dimensions of his character. Ali's intuition satiated those who had a thirst for it." And so, dear friends, we find that even after we die, people will remember us if we live a good and righteous life. And here specifically, we find that if we want to know the difference between just and unjust, if we want to know the difference between right and wrong, if we want to see somebody whose judgments are the best, if we want to go to the source of knowledge and wisdom, then we must turn towards Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Beautiful and profound lessons brought to us by the universal persona, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
صبحا وكل شرابا تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the producer of the program To My Brother, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Fayyaz Jafar. I hope you enjoy it.
How many times within our communities in reality when we see someone sitting next to us, do we say, Assalamu alaikum, how's it going, how are you? Not to make small talk, but because you actually care about the person who's sitting next to you, even if you never met him or her before. Instead of creating cliques, instead of creating like divisions between people, making a difference in the world, in reality, starts with you giving out of your own self. Who is the personality in humanity who is loved the most? No individual in the world is loved more than Jesus, alayhi salatu wasalam, right? Muslims love Jesus, Christians love Jesus, anyone who ever heard an anecdote about Jesus, they love Jesus, alayhi salatu wasalam. Why do people love him so much? Did Jesus, alayhi salatu wasalam, rule a big piece of land? Was he the king or the president of a nation? No. Jesus, alayhi salatu wasalam, had nobody amongst his followers except for three groups of people. He had women, he had slaves, and he had the poor. The three most isolated groups in human history are the followers of Jesus, alayhi salatu wasalam. Yet people love him so much because he made his very best effort toward making small differences in the community that he was living in. In the anecdote of Ashura, who do we love the most? Who's the one that everyone wants to argue over who's going to sponsor that majlis? Who wants to distribute food in his name? Abul Fadl Abbas, why? Did Abu Fadl Abbas allow for that water to reach the children or no? No, but he made an attempt to do so. We love people who love to give. We love people who try to make a difference. And when we come toward understanding what it means toward being a person, being an individual who is making their very best effort toward making communal, socio-political changes within society, it starts with one giving out of their own selves.
For the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
مع الرسول سبيلا
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. Ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
Despite Biden's rhetoric, American national interests are allied with those of authoritarian crown prince in Riyadh, says Manawi al-Rashid, author in an article titled Saudi Arabia, Why Biden Will Leave Mohammed bin Salman in Charge. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Many hoped that Biden would exert pressure on the U.S. most loyal Arab dictators to reverse the tide